Case number 24-1049. Vanda Pharmaceuticals, Inc. Petitioner versus United States Food and Drug Administration, et al. Mr. Hughes for the petitioner, Mr. Yellen for the respondents.
Good morning, Mr. Hughes.
Good morning, Your Honor. And may it please the court, Paul Hughes for Vanda Pharmaceuticals. I'd like to start with why we're here. FDA has sought to arrogate to itself control over drug development. FDA has decided that it itself will determine which new drug indications are appropriate, and FDA has escalated the standard of evidence for drug approval far beyond what Congress intended, in part by refusing to consider objectively evaluate the scientific evidence that applicants submit. Now, Vanda is a pharmaceutical innovator, and it has suffered immensely. It has spent tens of millions of dollars to develop a novel treatment for jet lag. The evidence, in our view, is overwhelming that Hetlioz works to treat this condition. People fall asleep far faster and stay asleep far longer than FDA requires for all other sleep medications.
But that's just a sleep disorder, isn't it? There's a difference between a sleep disorder and jet lag disorder, isn't there?
Well, yes, Your Honor. There are 18 approved medications for a variety of sleep disorders. Jet lag is one kind of sleep disorder. And our evidence is that this works, essentially better than any product that's been approved for all the other forms of sleep disorders. But ultimately, we think this case doesn't require the court to make a determination as to this drug is necessarily approvable. We think where FDA absolutely went wrong was denying Vanda a hearing. The evidence to us is quite clear that there are a multitude of disputes of facts. So everything that's in part two of our brief, both our opening brief and our reply brief, illustrate the broad variety of true disputes that exist in this case. And because of those disputes, our principal submission to the court was that essentially the grant of summary judgment, the denial of a hearing, was improper. So we don't think the court needs to wade into the various disputes, because those actually deserve a hearing where there will be a testimony by our experts, testimony by FDA's experts, and there can be a contested proceeding in order for FDA to fairly evaluate all of that evidence in the process that Congress created.
Doesn't that just boil down to your subjective sleep measures, which were not pre-specified? That's kind of like, I kind of dug down through it all, it seemed that that's kind of the main issue there.
So, Your Honor, FDA's principal contention is that because their submission is that we don't have evidence of efficacy as to next day functioning, what they call a criterion B, that they can grant summary judgment. There are three independent problems with that. First is the sleep experts show that you don't actually have to treat criterion B symptoms in order to get approval. The 18 drugs that I mentioned, as Dr. Roth explained, none of them, except for one only for half of its indication, actually has a criterion B indication. And Dr. Roth explains why you don't need criterion B indications.
So if we could just dig down on that for a minute, because my understanding of your argument is that the FDA says we treat essential features. We don't look at the criterion. We're looking at essential features. For jet lag disorder, the essential features happens to include a criterion B. Criterion, if I can finish, which is impairing next day function. You're saying there are all these other drugs or other disorders that have essential features that include criterion B, and drug companies haven't been required to address the criterion B symptoms. But when I actually look what's in the record of the disorders of insomnia that you point to, they don't include criterion B features. So chronic insomnia disorder has a single essential feature. It's frequent and persistent difficulty initiating or maintaining sleep that results in general sleep dissatisfaction. That's the essential feature. There's no criterion B in that. It goes on to say the sleep complaint is accompanied by distress, poor sleep. Those are criterion B things, but that's not an essential feature. That's just something that accompanies the essential feature. So if I can finish, likewise, short-term insomnia disorder, same thing. There's a singular essential feature and it's accompanied by criterion B features. So I don't think this record supports your argument that the FDA is being inconsistent when it talks about essential features. Because the essential features can include A, it can include B, it can include D. for jet lag disorder, it happens to include B, and there are plenty of other ones where they don't include B. I just don't think this record supports your argument.
So let me address this in a multitude of ways. So first, I have two independent arguments, even if the court rejects me on that, that show why we've actually proven next day functioning. So even if we have to, we have a dispute of fact as to whether we've proven next day functioning. We also have a dispute as to whether or not a narrowing of the indication would solve that. That's my point one. I want to come around to that. So I'll get to the court's question. The point two, before I get directly to the court's question, is our principal contention is that what actually qualifies as jet lag disorder is a scientific issue. It's not an FDA regulatory issue. This is decided by sleep medicine experts, some of which may reside at FDA, but not all of which.
In the ICSD, by sleep experts? Are you disputing that the ICSD is an appropriate source?
Yeah, and let's talk about the ICSD. So if the court looks to Joint Appendix page 2088, this is the ICSD listing. And so this is the description of chronic insomnia disorder. And as the court noted, diagnostic criteria B includes, for example, fatigue and malaise. And there are nine of them, and that's at Joint Appendix page 2085 to 2086. Then at page 2087 is where the ICSD begins discussing its description of essential features. And if we turn the page to 2088, this is all in the description of essential features. It describes everything that is contained under criterion B.
No, I don't think so. I think just because there's a section of the document that says essential features, you have to read the document. The document more specifically says, as I said, for chronic insomnia disorder, the essential feature, one feature is, and it's one sentence.
But Your Honor, there's a whole description. This is under the heading. So at 2087, there's the heading essential features. And then at 2008.
No, I understand the heading says essential features, but you have to read that section. And within it, there's a sentence that identifies what the real essential feature is.
But then if you turn to page 2089, it describes associated features. What we think, and this is what Dr. Roth, I believe, describes, is that what is contained under the heading essential features are the essential features of the disorder. It's not just one single sentence. It
is. I don't think we cannot read that particular provision, the sentences say, which don't support your
argument. The heading says essential features, and it has multiple paragraphs that describe essential features, and has a second description of what associated features.
I'm just saying you have to read the section. Just because the heading says essential features doesn't mean everything that's in that is an essential feature.
And Your Honor, I think this is an interesting dispute, which is exactly the kind of thing that goes to a hearing, because you can have sleep experts.
I think not, because I think it shows that you haven't met your burden to establish that there's any problem with the way the FDA handled this.
But again, as I said, this argument is sort of one of multiple independent arguments that we present. So even if I can't convince the court that everything that's under essential features is actually essential features, as distinct from associated features, which is separately spelled out by the ICSD, which is how Dr. Roth, our sleep expert, says one trained in sleep medicine would understand this, which shows that there's a distinction between insomnia. I think that's pretty powerful, and I think that on its face deserves a hearing. But even if the court disagrees with that submission, I appreciate not to convince Your Honor, we have lots of evidence that even show we do show next day functioning. This is with the KSS and the VAS scales. Sure. So on the KSS and the VAS and the other associated evidence of next day functioning, we think there is a tremendous wealth of evidence that exists in the record demonstrating how individuals report that they have substantially improved next day functioning as a result of taking this drug. I think what FDA is.
What about the pre-specification?
Yeah, so Your Honor, there are two problems with the FDA's pre-specification analysis. The most important that I'll point the court to that FDA has essentially no response to is we provided an expert declaration from Dr. Platt, which did an analysis showing in this context, what you're trying to control for with pre-specification is what's called type 1 error. That's the result of a potential false positive. So as FDA's analysis points out, they're not wrong in an abstract matter, that you do pre-specification so as to avoid doing a post hoc analysis and finding data that points to a conclusion but has a false positive risk associated with it. That's the general theory. So I don't disagree in the general abstract. That is one thing that one considers. What Dr. Platt did, though, is and said, let's look at the actual risk of type 1 error in the facts of this case using all the evidence before us. This is at page 2,299 of the record, where Dr. Platt has his conclusions. And he says there are 22 separate endpoints that have been shown in this throughout all of the studies. He did a meta-analysis. And he said all 22 endpoints show directional improvement. And so in that context, where everything shows that this product works, the risk of there being type 1 error is negligible. And he said there's no material risk.
Isn't one of the things that the FDA said about Platt's declaration was that essentially what you did was take your answer to each individual study suffers the same flaw was to do a meta-analysis of all the studies with the same flaw. And that can't fix the flaw. It's just now intrinsic and embedded into your meta-analysis.
That's what they said. And frankly, that's an absurd position because the whole point of Dr. Platt, who's an expert in statistics, is to say, I know what you're trying to control for as a general matter is type 1 error and the reasons that you have pre-specification. But I can look in the context of this particular case, use scientific methods, and explain why what it is you're trying to control for in type 1 error does not exist in the context of the evidence that we have before us. So sure, if you look at an abstract theoretic matter, is that pre-specification have some value? Yes. But the question is, what does it do in the context of this evidence before us? And Dr. Platt says essentially nothing. And FDA has no response to that other than to say, well, it is also post hoc. But the absurdity point of that is he's describing from an expert perspective why the post hoc feature of this is not actually a problem. And FDA doesn't respond to that with any substantive analysis. They just essentially say no.
Give you a hypothetical. Like, I'm not an expert in, I guess, statistics or, you know, what's the best way to do a study. But it seems to me that what is at stake here, what's in play, is just a sort of a methodological accepted practice, which you should pre-specify to avoid a certain type of error. So if we had, for example, a sample, and usually I think you need to have 30 or more for a sample, and Vanna came up, well, we have a sample of 5, and the criticism was, well, that's not a big enough sample. And Vanna got an expert that said, well, usually you need a sample of 30, but in this case, it was just so convincing that you should accept our sample of 5. Would the FDA not be able to be like, we don't accept your methodology? Because on its face, that's not.
So what American Sinomed, this court's case, I think addresses that, which says if you have a dispute of fact that is, quote unquote, palpably shallow, then a palpably shallow dispute of fact is not something that entitles one to a hearing. We don't think these disputes of fact are remotely to the range of being palpably shallow. And though to get to the particulars of this.
But what about my hypothetical, because that seems to be similar to what you're saying here. There's a methodology that's accepted. We didn't follow it, but we have an expert that says it doesn't matter. And what about my sampling hypothetical?
Well,
FDA, would you have to have a hearing on that if you only had a sample of 5?
I think the question is there a finding that that analysis is essentially palpably shallow and there's no meaningful dispute around it? And if one can draw that conclusion at the summary judgment standard. It's not distinct, I don't think, from how the court looks at summary judgment saying there's no actual essential factual dispute here, then a hearing would not be required. But in circumstances where there is a dispute, and here we have a pretty expert statistician who's explaining why there isn't a risk of type 1 error in this context, and we're not here, FDA has no actual technical or meaningful argument. They just have an attorney argument saying it has, you know, it's post hoc, but the whole point of the analysis is to explain why not all post hoc analysis is bad. And this kind of goes to the broader problem here is FDA can always say, run another test with another kind of pre-specification. You can always do more and more to try to eliminate what's called type 1 error. But the problem that you have is you lead to a graveyard of unapproved drugs because you lead to type 2 error, which is you have false negatives. If you make the standard too demanding, you have products that actually work, which is this product, that don't get to approval. So there has to be a balance between trying to control for type 1 and type 2 error. And again, I'm not saying this court strikes that balance. I'm saying you have a hearing to strike that balance.
Can I just go back to one of your other arguments is that your evidence does show the type of improvement in next day functioning that FDA is asking for?
Yes.
And am I right that the main evidence you're referring to is the KSS and the VAS metrics?
Yeah, there are other pieces of evidence, but those are the two principles.
Put aside the questionnaires and all that. But
those are the two principles.
Right. And so my understanding of what FDA said is you may have evidence that those are measures of sleepiness versus alertness. And you might have it might be true that if you say you're sleepy, that will correlate with next day functioning. But those don't capture the situation where somebody feels alert, but is still impaired in their functioning on the next day, which FDA says their definition is that that's the key sort of independent feature of jet lag disorder. You could, separate from sleep disturbance, because of the circadian rhythm change, you're going to have next day functioning problems. Do you have evidence that goes to that kind of?
Well, that's what Dr. Roth tells us, is that KSS in the sleep medicine world is sort of the gold standard for figuring out how somebody is performing on the next day, is looking at the KSS standard. It is, do you feel
in the sleep medicine world, not in a circadian rhythm? You've traveled to the other side of the world, and I don't fully understand this, but the FDA says, and the ICSD says, separate, even if you're sleeping totally fine, the fact that your circadian clock is so off is going to impair your functioning. That's an essential feature of jet lag. And I don't think Roth speaks to that.
No, what Roth says is the way that you get at that question about next day functioning is you do these surveys of people and you ask them, how are you functioning? What is your alertness versus your sleepiness level? Because that is what is directly tied to your functioning in a particular day, is how somebody's doing compared against their baseline. So it's not, the evidence that goes to criterion A is you fall asleep faster and you sleep longer. Those are objective scientific facts. The next question about if we get to criterion B, if that's even required, and again, we have a disagreement about that, but if it's required, then the question is, well, what's a way that you show your next day functioning? You learn from people what their objective or how they experience their performance, what their alertness versus sleepiness is that next day. And I think
so you're equating performance to alertness for sleepiness. And here's just one way of many that FDA made this point. I just want to know what your response is. So they say, quote, this scale would not capture the impairment of someone who felt subjectively alert, but performed poorly behind the wheel of a car.
So this kind of goes to the key problem is FDA can always come up with some other test of, oh, put somebody behind a wheel of a car. But nothing in criterion B says put somebody behind the wheel of a car.
It's just an example, right? The fundamental point is you could have somebody who does not feel sleepy, feels very alert, but is functionally impaired. And that you didn't measure for do any study that goes to that. At least that's my understanding.
That's wrong, Your Honor, because the alertness study is the person functioning. That is directly tied. That's what the evidence shows is if the person is alert, they have that degree of functioning. But again, these are not questions that I think this court needs to be deciding. These are questions that are scientific expert questions about people who actually spend their life doing sleep medicine. And now maybe FDA disagrees with Dr. Roth's explanation of what KSS and VAS show and how they demonstrate next day functioning. And that's a fine dispute for us to have on a full factual record where FDA produces what it is that they believe is the evidence that contradicts our evidence. But right now we don't have any evidence from the FDA. We just have FDA rejecting our evidence. And again, the statutory standard to bring it back to is substantial evidence. As FDA has said, this is often a low standard. We don't have to have overwhelming evidence of efficacy. We don't have to have every conceivable piece of evidence that FDA might wish we have. The question is, do we have substantial evidence of efficacy? And again, going back to the statutory standard, what's critical is there a qualified expert who fairly and responsibly concludes that we have demonstrated the effectiveness of our drug? We've provided two experts.
It seems to me that the implication of your argument is that anytime a drug company has an expert that says there's a question of fact here, the FDA has to hold a hearing. Because the standard says, you have to have substantial evidence, but the practice is if there's no way you can meet that standard, the FDA shouldn't have to waste its time holding a hearing. But what you're saying is anytime a drug company can get an expert to come in and say, actually, our opinion is there is a question of fact here, the FDA has to hold a hearing.
So I have a few responses to that. First, there is a relief valve on the palpably shallow, as American Sinomed, this court held. So it is not in every case. But second, as a factual matter, we describe in our brief, there have been only five since 2018. And I think this stretches back at least a decade. There have only been five requests for a hearing in all of FDA, and FDA has denied a hearing in all five cases. So we're not in a situation where FDA has a glut of hearing requests or a glut of hearings. They deny all of them.
You say that they never have hearings?
So far as I know, no.
So drugs get approved
the approval happens without a hearing, right? That the approval happens with a lower level official issuing an approval letter without a hearing. So there are no hearings on drug approvals, essentially. There are advisory committee proceedings. That's the closest FDA comes. But in my knowledge, and we go back at least to 2018, there's not been any hearings before the commissioners on drug approval.
So my impression is, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like it's a sort of interactive, almost collaborative process, because just from reading this record, it seemed like there was a lot of communication between Vanda and the FDA. We want to do this. FDA says, well, our concerns are this. Can you address this? You go back and have studies. You try to address concerns. You come back. So is that why and that there usually aren't hearings? Because usually it's more of a collaborative and less of an adversarial.
I'm not sure if we cited in this brief or else, but you know, a former general counsel of GSK was quoted as saying, when FDA says jump, if you're in the pharmaceutical industry, you ask how high. That is how usually drug approval works. So I will agree with that general approach. But the point is, Congress put into the statute a hearing mechanism for when there are actual disputes between the agency and the parties, the applicants. And you know, I think American Sinomed, which is sort of shocking to me, a case that the government doesn't even cite in their brief. It's a feature of our opening brief from this court. The government doesn't even cite it. If you look at the concluding paragraph of what this court held in American Sinomed, it is this case. And so here's what this court said. Sinomed presented FDA with scientific studies, which in the opinion of some experts prove that Proban may be safely used by dog owners without professional supervision. This was about an animal product. So that's our case. We have scientific studies, the opinion of experts. Sinomed's experts disputed FDA's interpretation and critiques of the study's results and methods. So we dispute FDA's interpretation and critiques of our studies. That's exactly what our experts do. They raised, too, a number of material questions about the appropriateness of the methodological standards the director attempted to graft onto the statute. Exactly what we're doing. We're saying the FDA is putting additional standards onto the statute. And last sentence, in short, the papers on file in this matter generate several material issues of fact and science that FDA attempted to resolve without a hearing in contravention of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. That is our case.
Just in terms of what the standard is, do you think is it essentially the same standard we apply in summary judgment cases? Is there a material dispute of fact, or is there some other more demanding feature?
I think as a practical matter, it's probably similar, Your Honor, to summary judgment standard. What the American Sinomed case said is, if a dispute, and I've said this a few times, is palpably shallow, then there would be no need for a hearing in those circumstances. So it can't be a trivial dispute of fact, or it can't be something that a court could say.
The mere material dispute.
That's right, Your Honor.
It's certainly a material dispute.
So, Your Honor, I think palpably shallow material dispute is probably synonymous. But yes, so there is. In back to Your Honor's question, we're not suggesting that every dispute automatically gets there. There has to be a material dispute, and we think our expert.
They're doubting is the government. I didn't see it anywhere. I just want to confirm they're not doubting that your experts are indeed experts in the field. Is that right?
No, they've
that's not the least bit contested.
So, yes, Your Honor.
So there's a joust between so-called experts on the government side and so-called experts on your side.
In Your Honor,
and frankly, material disagreement to the matter and issue, right?
Yes, Your Honor. We don't know who the government's experts are. At a hearing, we'd like to cross-examine them, and the government can cross-examine our experts. We contest those disputes, and we get a better process, a fair process, when those experts get subject to a hearing, and then FDA adjudicates what it views the correct result to be. Again, what we ask the court for is simply an application of American Sinomed. Again, when I was preparing and read this court's concluding paragraph, it feels to me like that paragraph could be written for this case, because we are in exactly the same circumstance. I don't deny these are important disputes of facts, and we are not asking the court. Let me say, the court does not need to resolve any of these. It just needs to recognize that these are pretty weighty disputes that warrant a scientific treatment.
Thank you. We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Anna.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Louis Yellen from the Department of Justice. I'm here today on behalf of the FDA. I'd like to start with Judge Pan's observation about the collaborative nature of new drug and supplemental new drug applications and describe how the process usually works and what happened in this case.
Let me go to the point that they're raising, which is what's before us. The statute says very clearly they're entitled to a hearing. It doesn't say maybe. It says they're entitled to a hearing. American Cyanamide is a law of the circuit. It is controlling precedent. And as I read it, and as I read other cases like it, it seems very clear to me that disputes among experts on a scientific question involving expert scientific judgment are material factual disputes. I cannot comprehend in reading your brief and in reading the other side's arguments how you can possibly say they're not entitled to a hearing. I don't know when, but experts, and you don't contest that they're experts, experts disagree with the scientific judgments that have been offered by the agency. These are factual disputes. They are in lots of contexts of the law. And I really was kind of amazed at your arguments, kind of like we exist. And if we look at the record and we think we're going to end up ruling against you, we don't have to have a hearing. That's not the law. That is absolutely not the law. And American Cyanamide is the law of the circuit.
Respectfully, Your Honor. So the law of the circuit is also PMRS and Campanos. And Campanos, and I'll respond specifically to American Cyanamide, but to set that up, Campanos says if the FDA has given adequate notice of the necessity of the necessary evidence, it can determine without a hearing that there is not evidence in the record that could support.
Their experts disagree with you about whether or not.
If I might finish, Your Honor.
Let me put yes, it in Your context. Honor. Their experts disagree with you about whether or not what's being proffered by them is adequate to support the conclusion they reach. You can't just say, well, no, we're not going to accept it.
Your Honor.
We don't have any regulation that forecloses them from offering the evidence that they're relying on. And it's certainly not implausible. I don't know who's right, but there's certainly nothing implausible about it.
Your Honor, as Judge Pan observed a little bit earlier, if it, just because an expert says something doesn't mean that there's a genuine and substantial disagreement of fact. An expert can make conclusory statements that are not supported either by reasoning or by studies.
I read these expert statements. They're not conclusory. They're going through what's before you, and they're saying, here's the way we analyze it. And that's a dispute between experts. This goes on all the time in the forensic science world, goes on all the time.
Respectfully,
competing
Your Honor.
Competing experts disagree on how you assess the record and what's a viable conclusion in light of your assessments. That's a factual dispute.
Respectfully, Your Honor.
Is that a factual dispute?
No, Your Honor.
It's not a factual dispute.
No.
Because the agency says no?
If I might respond, Your Honor. The dispute here is about standards, not about facts. For example, the dispute about whether the so-called subjective endpoints, the KSS and so forth, produce statistically supportable studies is about whether or not you can have a study that does not pre-specify its analytic methods and whether that can support robust findings from the study.
And they've answered your contentions on that. They've answered it in a way that is entitled to be listened to, respected, and then heard, and then you make findings after you listen to both sides.
Your Honor.
I must say, I didn't want to have to go through this, but I did go through it, and what they've said is not stupid or implausible. These are really smart people in the field in which you're claiming to have expertise as well, and they completely disagree with you on how you assess what's before us. The statute seems absolutely clear they're entitled to a hearing. You may win, but they're entitled to a hearing.
Respectfully, Your Honor, if an expert says 1 + 1 = 3, you're not entitled to a hearing. And the argument about statistical...
Because 1 + 1 = 3 is discernibly wrong.
And, Your Honor...
What you're saying is not discernibly right. You're saying we don't assess sleep disorder in that way. Another expert says, no, you can assess sleep disorder in this way as distinguished from your way. You are not discernibly right. I don't know whether they're right. There's a dispute between experts, and what we do in the law and in the forensic science fields goes on all the time in the challenges under Daubert. This is what happens. Experts come together. They disagree on how you assess the approaches, the methodology, the results, and what they mean. That's why you have hearings.
But Your Honor,
you have the judge say in those kinds of cases, I'm just deciding it. I don't care what the experts say.
Your Honor, that's not entirely correct. Even in the Daubert
setting. Entirely correct?
Even in the Daubert setting, there are circumstances where you don't get to a hearing because the experts have not.
The 1 + 1 = 3.
Right, Your Honor. And pre-specification is a basic method of statistical analysis. It is so basic. It is so fundamental that the FDA has guidance going back decades about the need for pre-specification in statistical research.
Are you afraid of a hearing to make that point? You're afraid they might come up with something?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Will disprove your point? I don't get it. The statute's so clear on their right to a hearing.
Your Honor, and this court in Campanos, in PMRS, in multiple opinions has recognized that unless there is a substantial and genuine issue of fact, a hearing is not required. If so long as the FDA puts on notice the applicant of the sort of evidence that needs to be submitted, if that evidence is not submitted, and here there was not valid evidence submitted about treatment of impairment of next day functioning, no hearing is required.
Can we just go another level down on the pre-specification issue?
Yes, Your Honor.
So my understanding is the problem with not pre-specifying is that there's a risk of false positives.
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly right.
They enlisted an expert, a statistical expert, to specifically address that issue. And he concluded, based on some kind of analysis contained in an expert declaration, that here there was no risk or a very negligible risk of false positives. So, and the response seems to be, but you have to pre-specify to avoid false positives. But the actual specific response to his declaration in the CDER reply gets very technical. Doesn't seem to say you didn't pre-specify. Regardless, if they've shown, they have someone saying there's no risk of false positives here, why doesn't that create a fact dispute over that?
So the, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
The FDA order incorporates the CDER explanation.
Correct.
Rebuttal. And one of the things was the failure to pre-specify. Perhaps we used too shorthand an explanation, but the idea was the following. If you do a meta-analysis.
Is this in the record?
Yes, Your Honor.
I thought you said you used the shorthand and didn't explain this.
I was talking about our brief, which I believe Judge Garcia was referring to.
All right.
So, Your Honor, at 239 to 41 is FDA's discussion of the meta-analysis and the express adoption of the center's analysis, which is at 2449 to 53. The problem is, if you do a meta-analysis of a bunch of studies that have inherent flaws within them, those inherent flaws, as Judge Pan, I believe, observed in the colloquy with Mr. Hughes, those inherent flaws are going to carry over to the meta-analysis. FDA has explained that meta-analyses are useful when you have studies that pre-specify and themselves are analytically sound. Doing a meta-analysis that just carries over inherent statistical flaws is not going to be an answer to the inherent problem of the lack of statistical rigor in the underlying analyses.
I guess the point is the standard is not just, does that seem reasonable to us? It seems the standard is there a dispute of fact? And their entire expert declaration, it's essentially saying that what Platt did was totally useless because you just can't overcome the risk of false positives by doing this kind of meta-analysis. And his view, obviously, is you can. That's why he did it.
Right.
And you're disagreeing with it.
So
hard
that's
for us to say there's not a dispute, isn't it?
There's a dispute. It's not a dispute of fact. It's a dispute about statistical methodology. And in Simpson, this court said, and I'm quoting, explication of the proper method for evaluating statistical significance, and that's the end of the quote, is something to which this court defers to the FDA. The sort of methodologies that are used is not the sort of question of fact that summary judgment proceedings, excuse me, that hearings are meant to suss out. Conceivably,
you can't be serious in that assertion.
If I might finish.
No. I want to stop you in the middle of that assertion.
I was going to explain that assertion.
The argument is between equally strong scientific people saying, arguing over the methodology. And you're saying if there's a dispute over whether A and B are viable, that that is not something that raises the kind of factual dispute?
Yes, Your Honor. It might raise a potential argument about arbitrary and capriciousness.
No. I'm putting it right to the summary judgment kind of.
I know you are, Your Honor. I'm trying to give you my response, the FDA's response, which is if an applicant believes that the FDA has inappropriately adopted a statistical methodology, they can bring an arbitrary and capricious claim about the agency's adoption of that methodology.
If the FDA has a methodology that says 1 + 1 = 3, the only claim I can make in challenging that is that it's arbitrary and capricious. It may be arbitrary and capricious, but in part because it's factually wrong.
Your Honor, the analogy in this context is not the statement 1 + 1 = 3. It's what does the plus sign do? It's an argument about...
You must use the methodology whereby 1 + 1 = 3. That's the way we think about it.
No, Your Honor.
I'm just giving you my example. Use our methodology, 1 + 1 = 3. I can't challenge that as a factual matter?
No, Your Honor. It's not a factual challenge. It's an arbitrary and capricious challenge. And in fact, in American Cyanamid, the court held that the agency had acted arbitrarily and capriciously. It didn't say that the agency made an error of fact. The problem in that case was that the agency adopted a methodology without giving fair notice to the applicant. So I think Mr. Hughes' principal case supports the idea that arguments about methodologies are properly conceived of as challenges to whether or not the agency acted arbitrarily or capriciously. They're not challenges about facts, which are to be resolved in hearings.
I think most of us agree that your burden is high. You have to show there's not even a dispute of material fact. So we've talked a lot about this type 1 error issue. The other ground on which it seems to me you could win is if there was just no dispute of fact that the sleepiness metrics, the sleep versus alertness metrics, speak to the type of next day functioning that is an aspect of jet lag disorder. And I had some questions for Mr. Hughes about that, but I guess I would just like to hear your best argument on that issue.
Yes, Your Honor. Your line of questioning did mirror implicitly the FDA's understanding here, which is Vanda failed to establish that metrics concerning degrees of awakeness actually correlate to degrees of functioning or treatments for impaired functioning. So the example Your Honor gave is a good one. Individuals who report the same level of awakeness using the KSS scale might not perform very well in a driving test, for example. And that's not the sort of inquiry that Vanda undertook. It just took the scales, the degree of alertness scale, to be a stand-in for the impaired functioning without any underlying analysis. They have experts who say the KSS standard is the gold metric. Well, they do not have any studies or any underlying literature to show that the standards that they used are themselves indicative of the impaired functioning that is associated with jet lag disorder.
So the Combs Declaration, for example, has a whole section saying that this measure of sleepiness is a way of assessing next day impairment. And I'd like to see how you'd put the response.
Yes, Your Honor. The FDA specifically responded to that by saying those are assertions. The citations that were made do not refer to any literature, any studies, or anything that shows that correlation. The expert gave his opinion that there was a correlation here, but without any supporting evidence. And just And that is an example of the sort of conclusory evidence that was submitted along with Vanda's application.
That's precisely the kind of thing it seems to me you do in a hearing. They bring in, you say what you say, they bring in what my colleague has mentioned. And then if you think there's something that undercuts it, you have an opportunity on cross-examination or in presentation of your own case to show why what they're asserting is limited or of no use. I mean, I must say in reading what they offer, it certainly doesn't come across to me as implausible and unsupported.
I understand.
That's what a hearing is for.
If I might, I'd like to briefly return to where I was starting, which is to say the application process usually is an iterative process between the applicant and the agency. Disputes like the one that we have here are extraordinarily rare because the agency and the applicants agree on what has to be established. In this case, Vanda identified the ICSD standard as the standard for defining jet lag disorder. FDA accepted that understanding of jet lag disorder. And I should pause to say essential features of that disorder are critical here because that's the FDA agreed with Vanda that that standard accurately captured what jet lag disorder is. But, you know, whether something is an essential feature really comes out through this iterative process, what has to be established to gain approval of a drug. Despite the fact that Vanda itself identified the ICSD standard as the prevailing standard, Vanda supplied no valid evidence that there was actually an effect of its drug on next day functioning. Its principal studies concerned how well the drug allowed somebody to sleep. The studies that addressed degrees of awakeness suffered from the two different problems that we've been discussing, the statistic methodology flaw and the failure to correlate the degree of awakeness and other standards that they used with functioning. So on the standard that Vanda itself submitted to the FDA as defining what jet lag disorder is, Vanda's evidence was insufficient.
Evidence is insufficient. That's what a hearing determines.
Categorically, Your Honor, they identified a standard that says you have to have X, Y, and Z. They supplied evidence of X. They did not supply evidence of Y. So on their own terms, they failed to provide evidence that they acknowledged was necessary. And to be just for the court's reference, JA 2013 is a citation that shows that it's Vanda that supplied this definition that the FDA later accepted as the governing standard for this application.
So if I could sort of try to frame this in a way that's easier for me to understand, it seems like there are two levels of dispute here. There's the level of the actual finding that needs to be made through a hearing, which is whether or not there's evidence this drug does what it purports to do. And those are the types of things like factual disputes that are suitable for hearing. But before we even get to that level, there's another level of dispute, which is what kind of evidence can prove that. And it seems that there is no dispute as to what the evidence of the methodology was. We're talking about the methodology dispute, not the actual factual disputes about the drug. The methodology was, we have KSS, we have these other ones, they're subjective, we did not pre-specify, everybody agrees. And the dispute on that level is whether that evidence is strong enough even to get you to a hearing, because it seems to me it's the FDA's view that if you don't pre-specify, that data is not strong enough. I guess what Mr. Hughes would say, shallow level dispute. It's a very shallow level dispute because everybody knows through many decades of understanding of statistics and methodology that you have to pre-specify, because if you don't, your data is no good. So we don't need to have a hearing about whether pre-specification is necessary or not. That's not the type of factual dispute the hearing is for. The factual disputes for the hearing are, does the drug work or not? But there's a threshold question about what evidence can be used to get you to a hearing. And if you could explain, like, what is the FDA's relying on just decades of experience? You're saying that the FDA gets some deference in terms of that kind of threshold level. And I want to understand better, like, where does that deference come from? And what is the FDA relying on this case to say, this is a dispute that's not even worth having at a hearing?
Yes, Your Honor. So in Simpson, the court explained that FDA is an expert scientific agency that uses statistical analysis on a regular basis. And as a general matter, courts defer to the agency in the agency's views about what statistical methodologies are appropriate and necessary. I could also say just—
Is that in the summary judgment context or just generally?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't recall the answer to that question. I will say this, however, Your Honor. Simpson also went on to say that in that case, the statistical flaw was also so basic to statistical analysis that deference wasn't even needed. And the same is true here. Pre-specification is absolutely basic to getting robust analyses of data that are obtained. There are some references in our brief that identify some of the underlying FDA guidances, which discussed pre-specification. It is a standard that has been around for absolute, a methodology, I should say, that has been around for absolute decades and decades. And it is so fundamental that a failure to pre-specify is sufficiently fundamental that there is no need to have a hearing about whether pre-specification is appropriate and or required here.
And on your alternative ground, you said there are two reasons why it's not required. One is the pre-specification problem. The second is the one identified by Judge Garcia, which is these studies don't even address the situation where there could be impaired next day functioning. That a subjective person doesn't perceive, a person expressing their subjective feelings doesn't perceive.
That's right.
Is there any countervailing argument on that side? Or countervailing evidence that's been submitted on that issue?
Not that I am aware of. Not that the record indicates Vanda's experts attesting, stating that KSS is the gold standard and provides sufficient evidence and awakeness is evidence of next day functioning. But that is just an assertion that—
But that still just goes to awakeness as opposed to impaired functioning where you don't perceive that.
That's right. There is no evidence in the record.
There's no evidence in the record that there's a dispute about whether their evidence can prove that you can have impaired next day functioning that's not related to your perceptions.
There is no, so I want to be careful here. I think I'm quite certain that Mr. Hughes will say there is such evidence.
Okay.
The evidence he will point to is his expert, is Vanda's expert declarations stating that degree of awakeness is correlated with next day functioning. The FDA's determinations on that issue, however, was that there is no support for the expert's assertions that the two correlate.
The expert didn't rely on anything?
They cited data, which the FDA looked at and said, this has nothing to do with what you have asserted. This does not
respond to that?
Yes, Your Honor, throughout the entire process. Absolutely, Your Honor.
And the experts ended up disagreeing, right? That's when you go to a hearing.
Respectfully, Your Honor.
What they said, you can shake your head all you want, counsel. I mean, you know, be respectful of the process. I'm trying to understand what you're saying.
Yes, Your Honor.
And some of what you're saying sounds like gobbledygook because you say, well, they said X and they relied on Y. And they offered it, and so I'm sitting here thinking, well, did they offer something that was showing validity and reliability? And you want to summarily say no. No meaning what? What does that mean, no? That no one in their right mind could have looked at what they looked at and reached the conclusion they reached? Is that what you're saying?
That it was scientifically unsupported. Yes, that is what I'm saying.
Okay.
I guess my only follow-up to that is correlation the same as evidence of the actual thing that they need to prove? Is that
again, I need to be careful because these are statistical terms. I don't know that whether correlation or some other standard would be the most appropriate here. All I can say is there is no connecting fiber whatsoever That is, whatever the standard is, they didn't undertake tests, for example, to show that two people who report that 7 on a KSS scale have a successful driving ability given their report of 7, or whether they instead in a simulated driving endeavor would get into accidents on a regular basis, despite the fact that they indicated that they thought that they were very awake. There is no evidence of that sort. There is just the assertion that this is an adequate stand-in for functioning.
I understand. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd just like to jump right to Judge Garcia's question, if I could, about the evidence that exists in the record showing daytime functioning. I'd start by pointing the court to Joint Appendix page 249. This is Dr. Ross' first expert report, and if I can read from it, the visual analog scale VAS has been used to measure sleep and wake function in clinical trials. It is common within the sleep research community to use VAS to, and this is quoting, measure aspects of sleep and daytime functioning and the effects of therapeutic interventions on them. He cites to that the Zisapel's published article that was published in 2003, which we attach as Exhibit 180. That in turn cites to Nicholson, published in 1976, which we attach as Exhibit 129, which in turn cites to Parrott, published in 1978, which we attach as Exhibit 132.
This is the key issue, right? That everything you said could be true. Alertness versus sleepiness correlates with your actual functioning. That is sort of obvious and indisputable. And the common example given is if you're sleepy, you will drive worse. It's like, you know, having drunk alcohol. The key question is if someone thinks they are alert, do they still function well? Which, though, is a different and more specific proposition. Am I making any sense?
Well, perhaps, Your Honor, but what I just read is Dr. Ross saying, if you are an expert in sleep medicine, you want to know daytime functioning, you look at the VAS, and he cites the three articles saying the VAS tells you daytime functioning.
Right. And do any of those have anything to do with the travel-related circadian rhythm difference? That means even though you feel great, I feel great, but when I start writing, my hand is shaking. I would still report on that study. I feel alert.
Well, Your Honor, I guess I'm a little challenged in answering the question. In KSS, we have 5 separate articles that connect the use of KSS to jet lag particular. But what Dr. Roth is testifying here is that VAS is if you're a sleep doctor and you want to know what is somebody's daytime functioning like, are they actually functioning well during that day? What you do is you administer a VAS to them and you figure out what their daytime functioning is. It's a methodological tool that you would use for insomnia, you'd use for jet lag, you use for a range of sleep conditions because it measures what somebody's functioning.
Do you think the key is whether you have studies that say this is validated for the specific type of functional impairment that's associated with jet lag, with the circadian rhythm? And so the best, so when we look for that, it's in JA 249.
Let me give you a lot more. So Joint Appendix
2022.
So 249 is one place to start. But Dr. Ross' second affidavit, so this begins at page 2235. There is a heading that says VAS is an appropriate patient-reported measurement tool for next-day impairment associated with jet lag disorder. And then this continues for several pages.
It can be appropriate, but it could be that it's not enough to check every part of the problem.
Oh, and that's a conclusion that FDA could potentially reach in the course of a hearing. We'll dispute that, but...
Well, you don't dispute that you have no evidence about the issue of next day functioning, that you subjectively feel fine, but in fact you are impaired.
No, we have loads of this evidence.
That you have no evidence of that.
Oh, we have lots of evidence of this.
Okay,
we have.
Wait. Let's bear down because it seems that all of your studies are these subjective asking people how do you feel studies.
What the evidence says is if you're a sleep doctor and you want to know what somebody's daytime functioning is, this is what you do.
So I hear your argument to be that we shouldn't have to do that because all the experts say all we have to do is ask people what their subjective functioning is. But if we accept the idea that the definition of the disease and to treat it is you have to address these circadian rhythm things, you know, and one of these things is you could subjectively say, I feel fine, but you could in fact be impaired. None of your studies address that. Your studies do address, they are relevant. If how you feel is going to be correlated with how you function, but they don't address the entire problem.
No, I reject that premise. I mean, our studies show, say, if you're a sleep doctor and you want to figure out criterion B under ICSD, this is what you do. We do what sleep doctors say you do to figure out criterion B. We don't think there's...
Those sleep doctors, were they talking about jet lag disorder or just general next day functioning after a bad night's sleep?
They're talking what you do. This is what Dr. Ross analysis. It starts on page 2235. It goes on for several pages. He talks about the KAS starting at joint appendix 2242, and it goes on for several pages. He says, and he cites many articles throughout it, if you're an expert in the field and your job is to figure out...
I understand that. So your argument is that if experts want to look at next day functioning, they use this test. But the issue is, in this particular context, which is jet lag disorder, it says there's a circadian rhythm aspect that is not captured in some of these other sleep disorder scenarios. And in order to treat jet lag disorder, you have to consider the circadian rhythm effects and just merely subjective, relying on people's subjective statements of how they feel doesn't necessarily address that. So I'm not saying that your argument is irrelevant. I'm not saying that your argument, I'm just saying like it doesn't capture the entire question about efficacy for this particular disorder that has an additional...
No, definitely not. Because let's start with the things that Hetlioz is currently approved for is non-24 and Smith-Magenis syndrome. Those are circadian rhythm disorders. FDA agrees that I think we're really the only product that is approved to treat circadian rhythm disorders. That's what makes this product different than all the others. Most products just basically turn off your brain and knock you out, and that's why you have terrible next day functioning. What Hetlioz does that's unique on the market is it entrains a person's circadian rhythm, so that way their brain, if there's not having an external light source, in the case of non-24 or people with blindness and Smith-Magenis syndrome, chromosomal disorder, in jet lag, it's jet travel, induced phase shift. We know this is product works for the circadian rhythm aspects of phase shift because we're the only product approved on the market to do it, and FDA has approved us for circadian rhythm disorders. The objection the FDA has is not, does it work for circadian rhythm disorder? They've approved us for circadian rhythm disorders. Their new objection is, well, what is the effect? How does somebody function next day because that's a criterion B? And so to answer that, we've gone to sleep specialists who say, okay, if you want to answer that, you use VAS and KSS to get that data. That's the data we have. That's what the expert report says. So I don't think there's a way to disentangle this for circadian rhythm because, again, we know our product works for circadian rhythm disorders. FDA can't dispute that.
The studies address that, like the studies that you rely on here?
Well, I mean, there are a few things. It's the mechanism of action. So how this product works, we know that the mechanism of action is one that goes to the receptors in the brain that relate to circadian rhythm disorders. This is on the label that FDA has approved with the product. So, I mean, it's known that this is a drug that affects circadian rhythm disorders. So that's just sort of scientific background of how the mechanism of this product's action in fact works. But I know I'm getting technical with the science. What our request here for is for the court to apply American cyanamide. We don't think the court needs to address this. We just, I think, are entitled to a hearing.
Can you just remind me what the best language in the second Roth declaration is that you were referring to?
Yes, Your Honor. It follows under the heading VAS is an appropriate patient reported measurement tool for next day impairment. And he gives quite a bit of evidence that follows from there.
Which page are you
on? I'm on page 2235. And again, I think what I gave you at page 249 is pretty dispositive just to start there. I think that if you want one quote, I think what I gave you at 249 is clearest, where he says the sleep research community do use VAS to, quote unquote, measure aspects of sleep and daytime functioning and the effects of therapeutic interventions on them. And what he's saying is if you want to have measure therapeutic intervention and daytime functioning, you use the VAS. And he's citing three peer-reviewed articles in order to make that argument. And then in the page range between 2235 to 2000, 242, he goes through KSS and VAS in more detail.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement.